the Old Testament characters that are great examples of faith. In specific, we're looking at people who are part of and listed in that wonderful chapter that is Hebrews chapter 11. And if you've read Hebrews 11 lately, then you know. And if you haven't, I would urge you to go home and do so. But it is just a catalog of Old Testament characters whose lives have demonstrated faith, and it kind of summarizes down that point of faith for those people. So far, we've looked at I think three different people. So far, we've looked at Noah, and Noah was a person of great faith because God came to Noah and said, "Listen, I want you to build a boat." Well, he wanted him to build a boat on dry ground in a place where there had never been rain. And it says that he, for 120 years, preached righteousness all the while he was building a boat, believing that God was going to do what he said he was going to do. Secondly, we looked at Abraham, and God came to Abraham and said, "Listen, I want you to go to a place, and I want you to leave, and I'll just tell you when you get there." And Abraham, in faith, packed up his family and his belongings and left for a destination that he did not know, believing and trusting that God would tell him, and that not only would God tell him when he arrived, but that he would bless his family, and that through his family, all of the nations of the earth would be blessed, and that God would make a great family out of his life. Well, the third one we looked at last week was the story of Sarah. And Sarah was a bit of a different story, but we learned from Sarah that Sarah trusted God to give her a son, even though she was advanced in years. He trusted her to keep a promise and give her a son, in spite of the fact, as we learned last week, that Sarah was a bit of a work in progress herself, wasn't she? And we came to understand something that I think is extremely important for us as we live out our life of faith, and that is that we were reminded that God uses far less than perfect people. That not, in fact, none of the people that we've looked at so far are these perfect people that we might imagine, you know, come to church and sit in the front row in their three-piece suit every week. These are people who are ordinary people who struggle with life like you struggle with life, and yet God was willing to use them, not because of extraordinary ability, but because he invested in them an enormous amount of faith, and they responded by placing that faith in him. Now this morning we're going to look at what I think is one of the most colorful people in the Old Testament, no pun intended here, but it's the story of Joseph. You know, the Bible has a lot to say about the story of Joseph. In fact, the story is intermittently woven between Genesis chapter 37 and the end of the book of Genesis, which is Genesis chapter 50. So from Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, the story of Joseph winds its way through that extended passage. There are multiple things that we could talk about in Joseph's life that would be extremely instructive for us, that we could get great benefit from. We could talk about how precocious and arrogant he was as a child, and how he certainly didn't endear himself to his brothers. We could talk about the hateful, vindictive behavior of his brothers. They went so far as to sell him into slavery into Egypt. We could talk about his temptation at Potiphar's house, and how his persistence in doing right really defined much of his life after that time. We could talk about his time in prison and how he ended up in a place of leadership even though he had been falsely accused and was imprisoned unfairly. We could talk about his interpretation of Pharaoh's dream and the ultimate assignment to him as being the number two man in Egypt, which, might I add, was the ruling power of the world at that time. I have to tell you, I sat down this week, early in the week, to figure out which of these stories I was going to focus our time on, because there's no way in the world we could talk about all of them and gain from them what God intended. And so I wanted to be able to narrow it, and I was struggling to be able to do that, so I thought, well, okay, we're using Hebrews 11 as a basis, so maybe I should go to Hebrews 11, which I've read a handful of times in my life, but I figured I should go to Hebrews chapter 11 and see what the writer of Hebrews focused that conversation on. And I found it kind of interesting when I got there. In fact, I was not prepared for what I found. I've literally read Hebrews 11 more times than I could count. But I was surprised when I got to Hebrews 11 what the author of Hebrews actually lists as the reason for him being in that chapter. Do you know which one of the of those stories that I just told, which one of those is included in Hebrews chapter 11 as the reason that Joseph is in the Hall of Fame? None of them. Not a single one of them. When he lists him, and by the way, the writer of Hebrews summarizes all of those chapters in Genesis down into one verse. That's it. I mean, he narrows it down to one verse, and if you were to look at the story that he references, it's none of those. It has nothing to do with him being sold into slavery. It has nothing to do with him resisting temptation to Potiphar's wife. It has nothing to do with him going to prison or being the prime minister. Can you believe that from Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, the writer of Hebrews summarizes it down into one verse, and that verse reads like this: by faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the Exodus of the Israelites and gave direction concerning his bones. That's it. Oh, come on, aren't you a little surprised by that? I mean, of all of the things that you could pick, Joseph got into the Hall of Fame of the faithful because he mentioned the Exodus and told him what to do with his bones when he died. No great stories of faith, no lions slaughtered, you know, no women resisted, nothing. He just simply said, the Exodus is going to happen, and oh, by the way, when it does, take me with you. Obviously, there's more to this story than meets the eye. Obviously, there's a backstory here that we need to understand. I went back to Genesis chapters 37 to 50, and I found the segment that the writer of Hebrews was referring to. It's the last 12 verses of the book of Genesis. And in those last 12 verses, you find these two events that the writer of Hebrews alludes to. Before we get to those, we need to understand the backstory, though. The backstory goes something like this, and it's rather lengthy. Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, you remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Isaac had two sons, one of them was Jacob. And Jacob himself had 12 sons. One of those 12 sons was Joseph. Now, Jacob loved Joseph more than all of the other sons, because Joseph was born to him when he was an old man. He was late in years. And so Jacob made a coat of many colors, which was a coat of honor, and gave it to Joseph. Now, as you can well imagine, that caused more than a little resentment with his brothers. There was a great deal of jealousy between his brothers and Joseph. In fact, it came to the point where they hated Joseph, and of course, Joseph didn't help his cause any. He was a bit arrogant, a bit precocious. And then God didn't help the cause any, because God gave Joseph a dream that strained the relationship even further. You remember the dream? The dream went like this. They were out binding sheaves of grain in the field one day, and Joseph's sheaf of grain stood up tall, but the brother's sheaves of grain bowed down. Thus ends the dream. Well, you may not quite understand. The brothers had no problem with this one. They understood exactly what it meant, and they hated him all the more because of what they knew. Well, then Joseph had a second dream. And in this dream, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to Joseph. Now, that upset the entire family. Even Dad got upset about that one. And his brothers hated him even more. Fortunately, his brothers were shepherds, and so they went out and did what shepherds did. They went out and attended to the sheep. But a bit later, Jacob came to Joseph, and he said, Joseph, you need to go out and to find your brothers. And so Joseph did. And he finally tracked them down, and he found them out in an area called Dothan. And as soon as they saw Joseph coming, they started plotting how they could kill their little brother. Reuben spoke up for Joseph, and he didn't want to kill him. Excuse me. And so he suggested that they just throw him in a pit instead of kill him. And what was going through Reuben's mind was, I'll come back a little bit later, drag him out of the pit, no one will ever know the difference, and everything will be fine. So they did. They threw him in a pit, and then they sat down and started to eat, and they saw a caravan coming in the distance. And so Judah hypothesized, well, you know, what we could do is we could take our brother and we could sell him to the caravan, and they would take him to Egypt, and we wouldn't have to deal with him anymore. And eventually they did that. It looks from the scriptures that it wasn't the first one that came along they did that with, but some traders then came along, and they dragged Joseph out of the pit, and they sold him for 20 pieces of silver. Reuben apparently was away. He came back and found out that that Joseph was no longer in the pit, and that they had, in fact, sold Joseph. So they had to concoct a plot as what they were going to tell their father. So here's what they did. They killed a goat. They dipped his coat of many colors, ironically, in the goat's blood, and then deceived Jacob into believing that a wild animal had eaten Joseph. Meanwhile, the caravan arrived in Egypt and sold Joseph to Potiphar, who was Pharaoh's captain of the guard. So what you have is you now have Joseph living in Egypt in Potiphar's household, and you have Jacob, his father at home, believing that he is dead. Now, Potiphar liked Joseph. He was a good worker. He served in his house. Eventually, he became Potiphar's personal assistant. There was only one problem in this story, and that was that Potiphar's wife liked Joseph as much or more than Potiphar did. She just liked him a bit differently than Potiphar did. And she tried to seduce Joseph, and when that didn't succeed, she framed him and falsely accused him of rape. Well, as you can well imagine, Potiphar, who was the captain of the guard, had a little bit of pull, and so he had Joseph put in prison, and there he was living in prison for a crime that he didn't commit. But during that time, the Lord took care of Joseph. It seemed like everything that he did just kind of turned to success. And God granted Joseph favor in his eyes and in the eyes of the prison warden. And the warden put all of the prisoners under Joseph's authority. You know, that's a pretty good gig. If you can be a prison warden and say, okay, you inside take care of everybody else, and I'm gonna watch it happen. And that's kind of what happened in this story. About 2 years after that, while Joseph was in prison, Pharaoh had a dream. A dream which nobody else could interpret, but God gave Joseph the ability to interpret the dream. And he told Pharaoh what the dream meant. He said, you can expect 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Pharaoh was so pleased with Joseph and what he had been able to do for him that he made him second in command over all of Egypt. And at the age of 30, Joseph became the prime minister of the most powerful empire in the world at that time. Pharaoh put a signet ring on his hand. He clothed him in the finest clothing. He put a gold chain around his neck. and he made him ride in the second chariot, which is the chariot directly behind the Pharaoh's. And as he rode in the chariot, his attendants would walk alongside and they would call out to the people, "Bow down." And the expectation was that as certainly as they bowed to the Pharaoh, they bowed to Joseph. Joseph immediately began setting up the system and the structure so that they could collect food for the 7 years, during the 7 years of plenty, and have enough food to serve during the 7 years of famine. They stored so much grain that it couldn't even be measured. And exactly as Joseph had stated, the 7 years of plenty came to an end and 7 years of famine began. There was not only enough food to make bread for the people of Egypt, but they sold food to the world. Now, the famine was widespread. It affected Canaan as certainly as it affected Egypt. And when Jacob learned that there was grain to be had in Egypt, he sent 10 of his sons to Egypt to buy food. Jacob would not send Benjamin because he feared that harm might come to him, and he was another son of his older age. And when the brothers arrived in Egypt, who do you think they had to meet to buy food? They had to meet Joseph. I mean, pretty simple story, right? They had to meet Joseph. Joseph immediately recognized his brothers. They did not recognize him. And so he played a trick on them. He accused them of being spies. He said, "Listen, you're just spies coming here to see how bad it really is here." And he ended up putting them essentially in house arrest. And he told them that they would not be released until they brought back their youngest brother to him. The brothers sitting there in house arrest began to feel remorse. They remembered back to what they had done to Joseph, and they began to think that maybe their imprisonment was punishment for the treatment that they had given to Joseph. Reuben even spoke up and gave them the "I told you so" speech. You know, he said, I told you not to harm this guy, and you did it anyway, and now look at us, here's where we are." And finally, Joseph decides to send all of the boys home with some grain, and except for one, and he kept Simeon in Egypt awaiting for the return of Benjamin. Now, Jacob was not remotely interested in sending Benjamin to Egypt. But when the famine got severe enough and the food was short in supply, he finally allowed the brothers to take Benjamin to go buy more food. Joseph, needless to say, was delighted to see his brother Benjamin, and he invited all of the brothers to his household for a feast. But Joseph had another trick up his sleeve. He had his servants place a silver cup in the bag of grain that belonged to Benjamin, and then it had his servants accuse Benjamin of stealing the cup. And they brought Benjamin and all of the brothers back to Joseph's house. And after toying with them for a little while, Joseph finally told them his true identity. He consoled them. And he told them, he says, "Don't be worried about me being here, because God sent me ahead to preserve life." Eventually, Joseph sent for his father, Jacob. And he brought Jacob and all of his household, 66 people that were part of that household. And all 66 of them moved from Canaan to Goshen, which was part of the land of Egypt. Jacob lived for another 17 years. And at the age of 147, Joseph's father, Jacob, died. Now, all of that, and we're finally at Genesis chapter 50 and the last 12 verses of the book. After Jacob died, the brothers kind of woke up and said, "Uh-oh, we have a problem." And the problem is this: if Joseph still holds a grudge, if he's still angry about what we did to him, Dad's gone. Dad's not our buffer anymore. And this guy is second in command in Egypt. He can do to us whatever he wants. And so they sent a message to Joseph. The scripture doesn't make this clear whether this was actually happened or they made this up. But they sent a message to Joseph that said, before your father died, he told us to tell you to forgive us. So please, forgive us. When Joseph heard that message, he broke down and wept. And then his brothers came in and they bowed down before him. Sound familiar? They bowed down before him and said, we are your slaves. Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. I'm right where God wants me to be. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about the survival of many people. Therefore, don't be afraid. I'll take care of you. I'll take care of your families. And so Joseph and his father's family lived and remained in Egypt. Joseph lived to the age of 110. And then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will help you. And he will bring you out of this land, and he will take you to the land that he promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made his brothers take an oath that when God takes them from the land, they will take him from the land. They must take his bones with them. And so Joseph died at the age of 110. They embalmed him and placed him in a coffin in Egypt. And that's the story. This final part of the story of Joseph's life is really a summation of his whole life, isn't it? And if I were to summarize this part of the story, I would put it in these terms. The faith that you live with is the faith that you die with. Now, I know I risk oversimplification here, but on a broader scale, you could probably say it this way. The way you live is the way you're going to die. More often than not, the way we approach life, the way we live, that's the way we die. That's the mindset that we bring to it. The faith that we develop and live with in life is the same faith that we face death with. Now, Joseph was a man of great faith. He trusted God. He trusted his plan. He trusted his promise. He trusted his providence. Consequently, when he faced death, he could say with absolute confidence, God will keep his promise. So when he does, take my bones with you. Don't leave me here. So for a few minutes this morning, I want us to think about the faith that Joseph lived with and the faith that Joseph died with. The faith that he lived with is summarized in that real simple little verse in verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. From all human perspective, Joseph's brothers had every reason in the world to be frightened. I mean, they had treated Joseph horribly. I'm sure he remembered sitting down in the dark pit, listening to his brothers talk about killing him. I'm sure that he remembered being sold for a handful of silver coins. I'm sure he remembered the long trip to Egypt, wondering where he was going and what his new owners were going to be like and what they were going to want him to do whenever he got wherever he was going. I'm sure that he remembered mustering up enough courage to take the next step, only to encounter another obstacle. You ever feel that way? Do you ever feel like life is just one step after another, and you muster up the courage to take the next step, and you get there, and all you face is another obstacle? And you say, what in the world am I going to do now? I'm sure that with every struggle came the haunting thought that if it hadn't been for my brothers, I wouldn't be in this circumstance. But yet somehow, in the middle of all of that, he was able to forgive his brothers. When his brothers came to him and asked him to forgive, you can tell by the rush of emotion, this was what he had been praying for. This is what he had been longing for years. And when his brothers asked him to forgive him, he was able to do so immediately, not because he had some superhuman ability to forgive, but because he had already forgiven them in his heart. And he was just waiting for the moment when that could be actualized. I'm quite sure that there were many nights in prison when he sat around and he thought about what he would do if he ever saw his brothers again. But somewhere in there, his heart began to soften and his voice began to mellow. And I suspect that somewhere in the long dark nights of prison, Joseph had some time to think. And he came to know a couple things for sure. First of all, he came to know that the purposes of God always prevail. Now think about it. If you're in the middle of difficult circumstances today, and life's really hard, and maybe, just maybe, those circumstances are the result of what somebody else did to you, remembering that no matter what happens, God's purposes always prevail can make it a little easier for you to forgive, can't it? You know, it's easy to say that the purposes of God are always prevail. When those purposes are clear and you know what they are. But what about when you can't see them? And you don't know for sure what his purposes are. But you can be sure of this, whether you see them clearly or not, God is working out his purposes. And if he has to use someone else's evil to do it, he will. He will. Nothing could ever make what his brothers did to him right. Nothing. I mean, whatever attitude he brought to it, no matter how precocious he was, no matter how arrogant he was, no matter how irritating Joseph was, none of it was an excuse for what his brothers did to him. But that did not keep God from redeeming those circumstances by using them to advance his own purposes. He'll do that for you. This statement is simply the Old Testament version of Paul's comments in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, remember? And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose, we know that, don't we? Because listen, our knowing that is absolutely critical to our ability to move on, and certainly is critical to our ability to forgive those who may have harmed us. It's important to understand what this verse says and what it doesn't say. It doesn't say that everything that happens to you is good and you just have to find the good in it. No, let's be clear about this. Bad things happen to good people. We're not exempt from that. It doesn't mean that if you love God, he's going to make you healthy, wealthy, and wise, and everything is going to be good. That's not what he means by good. In fact, the verse, the word good that is in this verse refers to moral good or spiritual good. This verse doesn't just imply, it states fairly emphatically that bad things are going to happen to us from time to time. Some of those things you're going to bring on yourself. Some of them are going to be caused by other people who do things to you, by their carelessness, by their failures. Either way, bad things are going to happen. But for those who love God, for those who are called in harmony with his purposes, he will work in those circumstances, and he'll produce what's good for you. He'll make good come out of it for you. That's exactly what happened in the life of Joseph, isn't it? His brothers hated him. They abused him. They sold him. Once he was sold, he was put in difficult circumstances, falsely accused and imprisoned. But in all of those circumstances, virtually all of which were outside of his control, God was working to bring about something good. Why? Because of Joseph's faithfulness? No. Because he had a purpose and he had a plan for what was happening in the world, and Joseph fit in the plan. And when Joseph came to understand that, when he began to see the purposes of God unfold, it was much easier for him to forgive his brothers. It was also much easier for him to trust God with bigger things in the future, wasn't it? Listen to me, if you love God, you are called according to his purposes. And whether you are going through good times or bad times, always look for his purposes. Listen, if you are struggling today and life is difficult, don't look at the circumstances. Find the purposes of God in it. What is God doing in this circumstance? What is he doing in others? What is he doing in me? What is he doing through me? And when you find those purposes and where you fit in them, that adds so much perspective to your life. His purposes always prevail. They will always happen. But there's another thing that Joseph came to know, and that was that the provisions of God often get personalized. Have you ever noticed that when God meets your need, there tends to be a name attached to it? That when God provides you what you need, it's often through someone else that he's given the ability to, and he's put in the right place at the right time and makes it possible for them to meet your need. And there's almost always a name to it. God places it on somebody's heart, or he puts someone in that right place at that right time. And that's important, because when that happens, two people get helped, don't they? I mean, the one who needs provision gets provision, and that increases their faith. And the one who has provision that can give it gets blessed, and that increases their faith. That's why God tends to do it that way. And that's precisely what happened in Joseph's life. God gave Joseph some unique abilities. He gave him the ability to interpret a dream that he didn't give to anybody else. He gave him extraordinary leadership gifts and extraordinary administrative gifts. And then he put Joseph in exactly the right place at exactly the right time, because somebody had to feed the world. And why not Joseph? Now, if you come to understand that God works in even the worst of circumstances to raise up people to meet great needs, then it gets a little easier to forgive the person or the people that put you in that situation. So Joseph was able to say to his brothers, I know you meant this for evil. There was no avoiding the inevitable. Forgiveness is not acting like there was no wrong. Forgiveness fully acknowledges that a wrong occurred, but it also trusts God that he will work through that wrong and accomplish his purposes and make his provision. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, so that a lot of people's lives could be saved. That's the faith that Joseph lived with. And so he became a person of extraordinary faith, and that faith served him well as he faced death, as certainly as he faced life. Faith tends to be cumulative, doesn't it? It builds on itself. You trust God, God proves himself trustworthy, and so the next time around you're able to trust him with a little bit more. Over Joseph's lifetime, he came to trust God implicitly. And so when it came time to die, Joseph was good with it. In fact, Joseph said, I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And then Joseph made the sons of Israel, that's the sons of Jacob, to swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. Now, your bones, your body, they were a far bigger deal in that culture and in that world than they are to us today. The pyramids were part and parcel of the major Egyptian religion and part of their view of afterlife. And when it came time to die, Joseph simply refused to be an Egyptian. Instead, he wanted to identify himself with the people of God. He was a descendant of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob. And Egypt was no appropriate resting place for the son of Abraham. He was a descendant of Abraham, and Egypt and all of its idols was no place for him. There's little doubt that Joseph could have had one of those elaborate tombs that the Egyptians were famous for. In fact, in Saqqara to this day stands the tomb of a prince whose names and titles are written in hieroglyphics. The name on the tomb is Aitzuf. Of all of the titles, there are two that are most interesting. One of those titles says that he was the keeper, the director of the king's granaries. And the other was the simple word Abrek. That word is found in the scriptures. That word Abrek is the word that is translated for us when Joseph was riding in the chariot and his attendants would go alongside of him and they would call out, Abrek, bow the knee. Many, many scholars believe that tomb that has been found was built for Joseph, but he declined the honor. And though his resting place could have been with the pyramid of one of Egypt's greatest monarchs, instead he chose to refuse the dignity because he would not become an Egyptian. He chose instead to be numbered among the people of God. Egypt couldn't make an Egyptian out of him. Exile couldn't make a foreigner out of him. And all of the glory of the Egyptian Empire couldn't make him forget that at his very heart, he was a shepherd boy from Canaan. In fact, many scholars believe that Joseph was never buried in Egypt, but that his body was placed in a coffin and left unburied as a reminder that, first of all, this was not their home. And secondly, as a reminder that Joseph didn't want to be left behind. Joseph was far more interested in the future of his people and the promise of God than he was in the honor of men. Joseph trusted God. And God made a promise to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, his father. And Joseph believed that promise, and that he believed that it would be fulfilled. And so he said to his brothers, I will die, but God will come to you and take you out of this land. And when he comes, and he will come, don't you dare leave my bones here. You take them with you. And so every time an Israelite saw the coffin of Joseph, he was encouraged that one day, we're leaving this place. One day the promise of God is going to be realized. One day we're going home. In Joseph's life, in virtually every biblical example we have, the way a person lived, the faith that they built over time, dictated the way they faced death. Can I ask you a question this morning? Have you built the kind of faith that you're comfortable dying with? Because the faith you live with is the faith you die with. See, I think many of us tend to think exactly the opposite. We tend to think that we can go through life and come to the end of it, and then we'll worry about our faith. I can't tell you how many people over my lifetime I have talked to who have put off their faith decisions till the end of their life, or at least they believe they have. They believe that they can go through life and live it as they want to live it, and when they come to the end of it, then they'll deal with that eternity issue. I've even heard some say, I'm going to live how I want to live, and when it comes to the end of my life, then I'll make peace with God. You sure about that? You're positive? How different from the person like Joseph. He learned and he grew in his faith, and he built a legacy of faith in God, and he built a legacy of service to God. You know, I've done a lot of funerals in my lifetime. I was asked the question here a while back by someone, would I rather do a wedding or a funeral? And I suspect everyone would expect the answer to be, oh, gee, I'd rather do a wedding. I can't honestly say that. If I'm doing the funeral of a saint, I'd rather do a funeral every day of the week than I would a wedding. There's something incredibly wonderful about supporting a family and about celebrating the faithful life of one of God's people when you come to the end of their life. There's such an amazing difference of what it's like to be able to celebrate a life where someone has trusted God and served Him and built up a legacy of faith. You know, and you come to the end of that kind of life, death's no big deal, it's just the next step. Because they so completely believe in the promise of God that even though that act of death itself can be difficult and terrifying and painful, that what is on the other side of it is what God promised and so much more. The faith that you live with is the faith that you die with. And for those who ignore that and go through life and live life the way they want to live it, or not even think about it until they come to the end and then hope to be able to make peace, listen, your spiritual direction is so cast at that point, unless God does a miracle of grace in that moment, you're going to die the way you lived. When Joseph came to the end of his life, there were no last-minute appeals. There were no, oh, Moab, what have I done? Lord, help me out here. There was just a simple expectation that I'm going to die, and when I die, I'm going to go to be with Him. And I don't even want my body associated with this other stuff of life. That's not where I belong. I'm the people of God. Take me where the people of God are. He said, this isn't home. Don't leave me here. Because God is coming for His people. And when He comes, don't you want to be ready? Father, I pray this morning that You would imprint this simple story. You'd imprint it on our heart. This isn't the story we expected. And yet there's something so profound about this story. Something so deeply meaningful about it that it forces us to look beyond the surface and to look beneath it. To understand something about the nature of faith and trusting the promises of God and building faith upon faith and experience upon experience. and building and leaving behind the legacy of faith and service. So that when it comes to that moment of death, we can honestly say we died with the faith that we lived with. Father, make us people of great faith. If we trust you, there's no limit to the joy and the pleasure and the fulfillment and the satisfaction of this life. But even life on this earth at the greatest of its pinnacle will pale in comparison to seeing you face to face. Father, I pray that we would live a life of great faith so we could die with confidence. We ask it all through Jesus Christ. Amen.